When you vacation with Norwegian Cruise Line, every day is a new day. Get a taste for Barcelona, then savor incredible dining back on board one day. Connect to ancient history in Athens, and then disconnect in our spa another day. Wherever the sea breeze takes you, come aboard and experience a different tomorrow with Norwegian. Visit ncl.com, call your travel advisor, or 1-888-NCL-CRUISE. Norwegian Cruise Line, ships registry the Bahamas and USA.
The rest of my life gonna start today.
The living room is where you make life's most beautiful memories. But your sofa shouldn't be the one remembering them. The new life-resistant, high-performance furniture collection from Ashley is designed to withstand all the spills, slip-ups, and muddy paws that come with the best parts of life. Ashley high-performance sofas and recliners are soft, on-trend, and easy to clean. Shop the high-performance furniture in-store or online at ashley.com. Ashley, for the love of home.
Here you have no compelling state interest that is worth consideration.
Maybe Mr. Roddick would feel differently.
That may be true. Is he in the room yet? I hope
not. He's waving a flag in the back, I think.
I think it's safe.
Light bulb went out.
The trick they play on Nucci must have evolved.
Happy Halloween.
Mr. Chief, Justice Scalia, I didn't mean to promote you so, quite so quickly.
Thanks for thinking it was a promotion.
Christina, you know how much I love this stuff.
Oh, I do. You and Hannah have done, 20 episodes that use archival audio from Supreme Court arguments?
About that much, maybe more. I cannot tell you how many hours of audio I have downloaded from Oh Yay in the last 5 years.
All right, Nick, why do you love oral arguments so much? I've known this about you since I started on the show, but I don't think I've ever heard your elevator pitch. So sell me oral arguments as a practice on the Supreme Court.
Okay. One of the first interviews I ever did for Civics 101 was with a guy named Larry Robbins, and he worked in the office of the Solicitor General. He had argued cases in front of the Supreme Court. And I asked him, what's it like when you go in there? And he said, it's basically just a conversation with 9 of the smartest people you've ever met in your life. And you've got 2 parties trying to make their case in front of them, almost like you're at a cocktail party. And when we think of the Supreme Court, we always think about these opinions they write, right? These long, winding, official pieces of writing with lots of notes and citations that live in the annals of history. But the arguments are human. The arguments are when the justices talk to each other and the advocates. And I love conversation.
I mean, you've sold me. So the oral arguments are a way to see behind the curtain, so to speak.
Yeah, see behind the robe.
You get to hear each individual voice. You get to listen to how they ask questions, what kind of tone they're taking.
Yeah, and when it comes to entertainment value, the oral arguments of the 19th and 20th century were much more like listening to a professor present their research and methods of an academic paper to other professors.
And how do they sound now?
Well, especially over the last 20 years or so, it started to sound a little more like, do you know the show Shark Tank?
I do know the show Shark Tank.
It's a lot more like Shark Tank, Christina. You're trying to pitch 9 investors on who's going to invest in their product. And a couple of them are ambivalent, a couple need to be swayed, and a couple are gung-ho for you all the way.
And that is an assumption that has no basis in this record.
Oh,
it's a stereotypical assumption. That's
it's
what it is.
It's not, because with all deference, that Justice Alito wants to rely on. Let me finish my point.
And if we're sticking with that metaphor of Shark Tank, are some of the justices kind of like the investors in the way that they have their personalities, and some of them like to talk a lot more? And
some don't say anything and they just glower at everybody. So oral arguments lately have become more like stages for the justices themselves to reveal their personalities. We're also able to better predict how a justice is going to vote on a decision based on what they say during the arguments. We can see how justices treat certain cases and the attorneys advocating in those cases in front of them differently.
Let's just say hypothetically, though. Hypothetically. And I know I'm going to get...
I know all the usual caveats, right, and I accept them. Oh,
thank you, Mr.
Yes,
Waxman.
I'm pretty thank sure you. Since you're asking me, I'm not going to like...
You're not going to like it.
But let's assume...
You're listening to Civics 101. I'm Nick Capodice.
I'm Christina Phillips. I'm the senior producer here at Civics 101, stepping in for Hannah this week because she is on a rare and much-deserved vacation.
Today, we are going to talk about oral arguments in the Supreme Court, specifically what this new era of oral arguments says about the highest court in the land and its role in our increasingly divided political climate.
So oral argument is a great thing to study because it's the one part of the judge's decision-making process that we can actually observe. Everything else is behind closed doors. They meet behind closed doors. The opinions are just issued. But oral argument, we can actually look at how they interact. And so that can be very revealing of ideology, strategy, etc.
This is Tanya Jacoby. She's professor of law and the Sam Nunn Chair in Ethics and Professionalism at Emory University School of Law. So Tanya studies what we can think of as the humanness of the highest court in the land. She looks at how the justices behave within the confines and expectations of the Supreme Court.
Traditionally, there's an expectation that the justices won't really refer to each other in pejorative terms, for example, in opinions. But the norms of collegiality maybe are breaking down a little as I think the court has become more polarized. Over time, more politically polarized. There's less of a sort of a consensus among the court now than there used to be. Just like the rest of society, the Supreme Court's becoming more polarized between sort of left and right. And as that's happened, we've seen a lot more of that sort of name calling in opinions. And we've also seen, my own research has shown that at oral argument, we've seen real changes in behavior, a lot more interrupting of each other. For instance, justices talking over one another, behavior like that, that's not as collegial.
And real quick, written opinions are basically the explanations of the justices' thinking once they've made a decision.
Yeah, there's like the majority opinion, which is usually authored by one justice with a lot of help from clerks, and it explains the rationale for that majority ruling. Now, if not all the justices are in agreement, there may be dissenting opinions, and sometimes there are what's called concurring opinions.
And that's when the justice says, I agree with the decision made by the majority, but there are a few things in that opinion that I disagree with or that I want to expand on, right?
Yeah. Or they came to the same conclusion that the majority made, but through a different legal reasoning.
But that's all on paper. And that comes at the end of the case. How do oral arguments help us get there?
All right, here we go. First off, arguments in the Supreme Court bear very little resemblance to a regular old trial. There's no evidence, there's no cross-examination, no jury. They're not deciding the case itself, whether somebody's guilty or not. They're deciding whether the laws involved are constitutional. The justices are reevaluating cases that have already been decided in the lower courts. And in order to get the Supreme Court up to speed, the two sides submit briefs. Briefs are short, thus the name, written arguments that lay out the history of the case and what they think the ruling should be, defending the previously made decision or presenting an argument why that decision was wrong.
And there are amicus briefs too, right?
Right. Those are briefs from the, quote, friends of the court, amici. These are legal and policy experts, scholars, people who are able to offer additional context and expertise to each side. And the Supreme Court gets all of these briefs before the oral argument even happens.
So when they walk into oral arguments, they already know a ton about the case.
Yeah, they're not here to like learn anything new. This is just a chance to ask each side more about their legal rationale. And each side gets one attorney to present its case.
And those attorneys are usually referred to as advocates.
Yeah, when you hear us refer to advocates today, we're just talking about the two attorneys. Sometimes there might be a third or even a fourth person who presents to the justices, but each person presents one at a time.
How long are oral arguments supposed to be?
It's not a hard and fast rule, but it's usually 60 minutes. 30 minutes for one side, 30 minutes for the other. They used to be longer. Sometimes arguments would go days long. But over time, the briefs have gotten more detailed and the oral arguments have become more succinct. Sometimes, it's not too common, the Chief Justice may decide that it's going to go an extra day or another hour or something like that.
So the advocates get up there and they just start talking until they get interrupted by the justices?
No, actually. used to be that way until about 2019. In that year, the court created a new rule where the advocates were allowed to speak for 2 minutes straight before the justices could interrupt.
2 minutes does not seem like a very long time.
That may be so, Christina, and all the justices have done this. But as an example, I'm going to tell you about Sonia Sotomayor. One time, Justice Sotomayor waited a grand total of 11 seconds before interrupting an advocate.
Mr. Houston, Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the court. The Social Security Appeals Council dismissal order in this case was a final decision because it marked the agency's last word on petitioner's application for...
Mr. Decision. Houston, if you believe that, is the government instructing its line attorneys to waive exhaustion...
Okay, she didn't even let him finish his sentence.
Yeah. And aside from this new two-minute rule and the general deference that the justices play to the Chief Justice, who introduces the advocates and manages the flow of everything, there aren't any real strict rules about how justices are expected to conduct themselves. Here's Tanya Jacoby again.
And I've done some research on how the justices behave to one another, for example, when they're hearing cases. And this is completely unregulated. So there are norms of collegiality that the justices are sort of expected to follow, but there's nothing written down. The justices always emphasize that they all get along very well, despite that they keep their differences to the substance of opinions and not, don't take it out on one another.
Fundamental problem that I think Justice Alito is pointing to, and you're sort of talking past each other. So maybe I'll explain his view. Strange, isn't that?
I can use the help.
I think I'll explain what is.
But sometimes that seems a little bit hard to believe. So if you listen to oral arguments from, say, 30 years ago, they are very boring, to be honest. There's a lot of just the advocates talking uninterrupted, the justices occasionally asking questions, and then the advocates will give long answers.
In a long line of cases going back to the inception of the
petition
Wagner
for enforcement,
Act.
The Court of
this
Appeals
court has looked at this
language,
substantive finding.
And this is on page 122, the third indented paragraph.
And it's not very entertaining. It might be informative, but it's not nearly as entertaining. Whereas now you hear the justices jumping in, asking a question, and then somebody else, one of the other justices from the other side, saying, well, what about this? And interrupting each other, and the Chief Justice having to step in and say whose turn it is to speak.
A debater is speech, but the great chef who's like, everything is perfect on the plate, and it's a work of art. It's a masterpiece.
Well, Your Honor, you have to confront that issue in every First Amendment case.
You know, General, my colleagues, I think, go to more elite restaurants than I do. But
same here, Your Honor.
I think that if in my dreams I could go to a Michelin, I don't know, 1/10 star, I don't know, 2-star restaurant, and there was...
You can hear this for yourself, gentle listener. You can just go to Oyez, that's OYEZ.org. They have recordings of every argument going back to about 1965. We love them. And it's not just the general attitude that is changing. It's what the justices are actually saying when they speak up.
What do you mean?
I mean talking more and asking less.
Okay, so when did this start to shift?
A lot of changes happened around 1995 when the country became more politically polarized. And we saw a lot of changes happening at the Supreme Court starting at around that period as well.
A lot of things happened in the 90s, but the big takeaway was that there was more fighting and less compromising between political parties, especially in Congress. Harder lines drawn in the sand, Christina.
Yeah, the 90s are definitely one of those times in political history that come up whenever we're talking about partisan divide, especially in Congress. Everything from the debt ceiling to the income tax system to impeachment. This was the era with the Contract with America, and there were just all these debates about decorum, partisanship, how Congress should run.
Exactly. And obviously, we cannot draw a straight line from behavior in Congress to the behavior of the justices in the Supreme Court. However, I will say the branches don't exist in their own little independent vacuums. Supreme Court justices are nominated and appointed by politicians. And it was this time period, Christina, the 1990s, that things started to shift.
So one thing that really changed starting around 1995 is the justices started talking more and more. And traditionally, oral argument has been limited to 60 minutes. And so that meant the advocates got to talk less. And so the justices, over that sort of 20-odd year period, were talking about 13 minutes more out of a 60-minute oral argument. So that's about 25% almost more, and the advocates getting to speak less.
But if the point of oral arguments is for justices to have a chance to ask questions and be persuaded by the advocates, could this just be a case of them being more engaged, more curious?
Well, there was zero increase in the number of questions that were asked by the justices during that time. That whole 25% increase in which the justices were talking was taken up by comments made by the justices. And so these conclusory statements the justices were making were a pretty good indication they were advocating for a particular position rather than inquiring through questions.
Conclusory statements, meaning that rather than asking an advocate to explain their case, the justices were getting their own point across instead.
Yeah, and this could be through posing hypothetical situations, explaining case law, or just straight up stating an opinion.
And we measured this in the most generous possible way that we could to show that there were comments rather than questions. So if an entire speech episode, if there was one single question mark, we counted that as a question, and still there was no real increase in questions being asked, all of that additional time was spent making comments, and so conclusions by the justices, rather than asking questions in which they could be persuaded. So that's the first real measure.
Tanya also made a note of when the justices were speaking the most.
Another measure is that if you look at who the justices talk to during oral argument, they use up more of the time of the advocate that subsequently, when the vote comes, they vote against. So they talk to the advocate that they're going to rule against. They're essentially sort of using up their time to a certain extent. And we showed that you can predict how a justice is going to rule, because remember, oral argument comes before the vote. You can predict how they're going to vote based on who they're talking to. And so they spend their time talking to the people that they ultimately are going to disagree with rather than the people that they agree with.
It almost sounds more like the kind of strategy you would see when you're debating something, a bill in Congress, where the politicians are trying to waste someone's time to deflate their argument.
Yeah, just running out the clock, you know? For example, there was a case called Gill v. Whitford, which had to do with partisan gerrymandering. And Justice Samuel Alito started his question to one of the advocates this way.
Mr. Smith, can I just say something, ask you a question about the political science?
And he then proceeds to talk for 3 minutes.
We are going to impose a standard. This three-judge court decided this, that. Now, it's been 30 years since being... All right, in 2014, it's been finally, after 200 years, it's been finally...
And at the end...
So this is 2017 is the time to jump into this? That's a question.
Is there a question there, Your Honor?
Yeah, there is a question there. There are about 10 of them.
This is like when you make the mistake of asking someone at a party if they've read anything good lately and they proceed to give you the entire plot of a 10-book series. And ultimately, it sounds like it sucks up a lot of that limited time that's supposed to be about how the law should apply in that particular case.
And then not only that, but if you combine these two elements of advocacy and you look at questions and who they're talking to, we showed that the justices are asking questions of the side that they ultimately rule for and making comments primarily to the side that they actually rule against. So what they're doing is they're making statements against the advocate to the advocate that they disagree with, and then asking questions, giving opportunities to speak to the advocates that they actually agree with.
Okay, so let's imagine I'm an advocate trying to suss out how my case is going, and I notice the other side is getting a ton of questions from one justice. But when I was speaking, that same justice spent 5 minutes waxing poetic on a minute piece of legal history. I might think that maybe things are going better for my opponent when it comes to that justice.
Potentially, yes.
And so all of these elements are aspects of what we call judicial advocacy, that the justices come in with a set idea of who they're going to rule for, and they speak for the position that they're arguing for, rather than just being open-minded and say, okay, here's your chance to convince me, advocate, tell me the answers to these questions.
Judicial advocacy. Basically, the justices are playing the roles of the advocates themselves.
Yeah, and just sort of to add to this advocacy thing, sometimes the justices seem to come to the advocate's aid.
One of the things that we identify is the justices stepping in to help an advocate who they think is not getting a point across that they want to get across. And so you have examples where a justice will lay out an entire argument to the advocate who is making that argument. And then the justice will say something like, is that correct? And the advocate will say, correct.
I have an example of this for you. Dean v. United States, 2017. Now, we're not going to go into the facts of the case here, but in short, it was a case about how judges decide mandatory minimum sentences in criminal cases. The advocate, Alan Stoler, was struggling to explain his point.
But the language that says consecutive also is meant to say that it can't run with those underlying predicate offenses.
Counsel.
So Justice Sotomayor jumped in and started explaining it herself.
You can't impose a sentence simply because you disagree with the guideline.
So then Justice Sotomayor began walking through his argument and how the law should apply in this case.
And then she says, correct.
5-3, correct?
Correct.
And then Justice Sotomayor says, so it's not negating Congress's purpose if a district court gives one day, correct?
Gives one day, correct?
And Advocate Stoller says, I would say not. Justice Sotomayor, and one day is a day of punishment, isn't it? Alan Stoller, no question as to that, Your Honor, yes. Justice Sotomayor, isn't that your point? And then Alan Stoller says, basically it is that.
We also have to take into consideration.
So Justice Sotomayor is basically feeding Stoller his lines.
Yeah, and it is so obvious, it's so blatant, that another justice points it out.
Now, later in the argument, Advocate Stoller confuses Justice Sotomayor with Justice Kagan, which happens sometimes, particularly among the female justices.
But as Justice Kagan and I discussed, one day is an additional punishment.
And Justice Kagan said something very unusual. She said, she's Justice Sotomayor. She was the one helping you.
I'm sorry. She was wrong end.
Helping you.
I'm sorry.
This is the
I was the one who wasn't.
I got my ends mixed up. I'm sorry.
Wow, I love that she just says that.
Now, that is very unusual for a justice to actually acknowledge what is going on, that Justice Sotomayor was stepping in and engaging in advocacy and explicitly saying, this justice is trying to help you, and I am not. I am trying to ask you a question. And so that was a little bit of a breach of the collegiality norms by acknowledging what was actually going on in this case, that Justice Sotomayor went to this great length to spell out this advocate's argument for him, and he just kept saying, correct, correct. No, you are right. Absolutely, Your Honor. Yes, that's right. And anytime you see in the transcript an advocate saying, correct, yes, absolutely, yes, that's what I meant.
Thank you, Justice Ginsburg. That's precisely correct.
That's entirely correct, Your Honor. And
then you know that the justice is doing this particular type of advocacy, this sort of softball questions of saying, let me help you.
Is this sort of thing common or kind of a one-off scenario?
Tanya said that this was happening a lot.
Okay, so where is this coming from? You mentioned that this shift in the Supreme Court started happening in the 1990s, but I also know from being a person in the world, interacting with other people, that there's usually one person at the party who kind of sets the tone. Was there something like that at the Supreme Court?
Yeah, so there was that guy at the party for sure. He was the equivalent of the guest who put a lampshade on his head. This is the justice that elicited more laughs in the Supreme Court than any other.
A lot of people used to say that this change came about when Justice Scalia entered the court.
I'm Scalia.
Yes, sir. I remember that.
That he changed the culture of oral argument and jumped in and asked a lot of questions.
A conviction eliminates your marriage? Is that...
Any, it doesn't.
You don't have to get a divorce, you just have to get convicted. It's a good deal.
I think it's a better deal.
And my research shows that that's actually not true. The only thing that changed when Justice Scalia entered the court was this increase in the number of comments rather than questions.
Justice Antonin Scalia, a conservative justice appointed in 1986 under President Ronald Reagan, asked more questions and spoke more often in oral arguments than pretty much anyone else in history. And he used oral arguments to get his own feelings across to other justices. He also wrote more. He has the current record for the most concurring opinions. And he's number two in the number of dissents.
Who's number one?
John Marshall Harlan, otherwise known as the Great Dissenter.
Ah, the man who made the famous sole dissent in Plessy v. Ferguson.
The very same.
Okay, so Justice Scalia is like this huge presence on the court.
Oh, absolutely. He cracked jokes. He made witty little asides. He bantered more with his colleagues and with the advocates.
Deviant would be departing from established norms.
There are established norms of violence.
Well, I think if we look back...
I mean, some of the Grimm's fairy tales are quite grim, to tell you the truth.
So to the extent that Justice Scalia has changed anything, it was just this first element of advocacy that I talked about. Increased. But what happened over time is that all of the justices started behaving differently.
It's kind of like you join a friend group where people swear a lot, and gradually you start swearing a lot too. Like, in order to be heard in court, these justices have to compete with these other justices who are also jumping in and taking up space.
Yeah, and this is true even of Justice Clarence Thomas, who once went 10 years without asking a single question during oral arguments.
As somebody who can't stop myself from asking questions and speaking up, I cannot imagine.
He barely spoke at all. He'd go entire years without talking. But what's interesting is that on the few occasions previously when he did talk, he followed the same pattern. You could predict how he was going to vote because the few times that he did talk, he would be making comments to the advocate that he ultimately disagreed with. So even when the justices don't say much, it's still pretty clear what they're doing, this sort of strategic behavior. Justice Thomas now talks a lot more ever since the pandemic, and I can talk about why that might be, but we see all of the justices now being very active and very engaged and sort of dueling with each other sometimes.
So we're going to talk about how the new rules around oral arguments have contributed to this change in the dynamic, why that happened, why Justice Thomas is now speaking up more in court than he ever used to, and also why all interruptions are not created equal. But first, we got to take a quick break. But before we go, if you like things like the top 10 best jokes made during Supreme Court arguments, you're going to love our newsletter. It's called Extra Credit. It comes out every 2 weeks. It's fun. It's free. And you can sign up at our website, civics101podcast.org.
Vacations are always good. Sometimes they're even great. And Celebrity Cruises is about to ruin all of that. Because once you explore with us, you'll never want a vacation any other way. And with new quick Caribbean escapes, you'll never want a weekend any other way either. Celebrity Cruises. Nothing comes close. Visit celebrity.com, call 1-800-CELEBRITY, or contact your travel advisor. Ships Registry, Malta and Ecuador.
Look around. You can find cars like these on AutoTrader. Like that car riding in your tail. Or if you're tailgating right now, all those cars doubling as kitchens and living rooms are on AutoTrader too. Are you working out and listening to this ad at the same time? Well, multitasking pro, cars like the ones in the gym parking lot are for sale on AutoTrader. New cars, used cars, electric cars, maybe even flying cars. Okay, no flying cars, but as soon as they get invented, they'll be on AutoTrader. Just you wait. AutoTrader.
The living room is where you make life's most beautiful memories. But your sofa shouldn't be the one remembering them. The new life-resistant, high-performance furniture collection from Ashley is designed to withstand all the spills, slip-ups, and muddy paws that come with the best parts of life. Ashley high-performance sofas and recliners are soft, on-trend, and easy to clean. Shop the high-performance furniture in-store or online at ashley.com. Ashley, for the love of home.
We're back. You're listening to Civics 101. We're talking about how, over the last couple of decades, Supreme Court oral arguments have gotten a lot more exciting.
Sometimes they make some snarky comments about, well, my question wasn't answered, so, you know, answer this question first. Or they'll say things like, well, Justice Alito's point was this, but I want you to answer my question first. Or they'll actually rebut each other's points.
This is Tanya Jacoby again. She is a legal scholar who studies Supreme Court oral arguments. And just before the break, she told us how, starting in the mid-1990s, justices started talking more and advocating more during oral arguments than they had hitherto. And also that things have just felt more lively. There's a lot more crosstalk as entertainment.
As entertainment, it's far better. For those of us who had to listen to it, but in terms of informativeness about the actual content of the cases, it's probably much less so. But it's very informative about what the justices are thinking and how they're likely to rule.
I have to be honest, listening to some of these oral arguments, I feel like I would find it really stressful to be interrupted
all the time.
I think it would be enraging. I don't think I could do it. I would be so annoyed.
You were just so annoyed there when I just pretended to interrupt you. Sorry for the joke interruption there, Christina. I do have to say that interruptions are pretty integral to how oral arguments work. These advocates are rarely going to just be able to speak freely and pause and say, does anyone have any questions? The justices are the ones running the show. They've got control over the argument.
So I remember that rule we were talking about earlier where the advocates are allowed to speak for 2 minutes before the justices can interrupt. But you also said before the break that we were going to talk about why all interruptions are not created equal. And I think I know where you're going here, but are some justices, some advocates, more likely to be interrupted than others? Are some more likely to do the interrupting?
So back in 2017, I did this first project where I showed that the female Supreme Court justices are interrupted as much as 3 times as often as the male justices. And they're interrupted both by their colleagues, by other justices, but also by advocates. And it was overwhelmingly by male advocates who were doing the interrupting.
I don't want to hear this, but I kind of actually do want to hear this.
Well, suppose there were 3 unrelated cases.
Pardon?
If court would under the Supreme Court. Well, Justice Ginsburg, I think it's the operation of the Supreme Court.
I'm sorry, he did refuse to
sell. Could I get the answer to the question? So,
May I ask you about the jurisdictional question?
But you there's no compulsion.
Well, counsel, I don't want to interrupt your answer to Justice Sotomayor, but just to pick up on a point that you made.
And this got a lot of attention, and both Justice Ginsburg and Justice Sotomayor commented on it. The Chief Justice was asked about this, and subsequently, Justice Sotomayor has made multiple statements that the court really changed because of this research. And things improved, that some of the male justices apologized to her, and the chief got more involved in controlling who got to speak, sort of referee among the justices.
Justice Sotomayor said that things improved, but does Tanya have any data on this?
In terms of justice-to-justice interruptions, nothing changed. It's still just as bad as before. The female justices are being interrupted just as much, about 3 times as often as the male justices. So no improvement there. But the other thing we looked at is whether that's true that the Chief Justice is intervening more to referee as to who gets to speak. And what we found, interestingly, is that Chief Justice is refereeing a lot more, but he actually started refereeing earlier than 2017, before we called for him to do it. He was already starting to do it. And there's basically a straight line up in terms of when you graph, to show over time, the chief has done this increasingly more since about 2010.
The Chief Justice is the moderator of the oral argument. They step in if people are talking over each other or if someone needs to be cut off, or they do other things just to keep the argument productive. And how they do that, it's kind of up to them. And what Tanya observed is that Chief Justice Roberts had altered his style of doing things.
He became Chief Justice in 2005. He didn't do much refereeing at all. He began refereeing in around 2010, but interestingly, he refereed more in favor of the male justice. So he would, when there was an interruption, even when the men were interrupting, he'd give the floor to the men for the first few years. And then from about 2015, he started intervening and handing the floor to the female justices when they were interrupted.
Why don't you deal with Justice Sotomayor's question first, and then Justice Alito's?
Thank you.
And he's doing this considerably more now. Around about 3 times as often he's intervening to say when a female justice is interrupted. And I think even the Chief Justice doesn't know that he's doing this, perhaps. Or maybe he does, but he doesn't want to say that he's doing it. So that, to me, is one of the most interesting results that came out of it.
But there's a little wrinkle in all of this. And that little wrinkle is the COVID-19 pandemic.
Of course it is.
During the pandemic, when the justices stopped hearing cases in person and started hearing them by telephone, the Chief Justice unilaterally also changed the way that oral argument was ordered during that time, during that pandemic period. And he came up unilaterally, and this is what I mean, where some of the other justices weren't entirely happy, apparently. He decided that the justice would speak in order of seniority.
Wait, he can do that?
Oh, yeah. Like we talked about in our episode on Supreme Court ethics, link in the show notes, the Supreme Court kind of makes its own rules for how it operates. And so Chief Justice Roberts decided that with all the oral arguments happening virtually, everyone would not be allowed to jump in whenever they wanted. He would call on people instead, and he would go in order of seniority.
And so he would get to ask his own questions first as the chief, and then Justice Thomas would get to speak next, uninterrupted, without any sort of competition from the other justices. And suddenly, Justice Thomas started engaging and asking questions and making comments and behaving like the other justices.
Justice Thomas?
Thank you, Chief Justice. Mr. Stewart, it would seem a bit odd, as you suggest, that we sever the exception, but here it doesn't seem...
So in terms of Justice Thomas, some people used to say, you know, it was an abdication of responsibility by Justice Thomas not to speak at oral argument, and people would report how he actually looked like he was asleep often at oral argument. He would close his eyes and lean back and just really not engage. And there were various theories about why Justice Thomas didn't speak an oral argument. But he himself did eventually speak about this. And he said essentially that he was, when he was younger and he grew up speaking a dialect that sort of marked him as from a particular region in the South that, you know, and from a less educated background, and he was very self-conscious about it. And so that was one element, but he also was on record saying he just didn't think oral argument was very informative, or he thought his colleagues spoke enough. So he sent sort of various mixed messages. What's interesting is that back in the day, 30, 40 years ago, there were other justices who spoke as little as Justice Thomas. So he was arguably sort of a bit of a remnant from an earlier era, perhaps. But as I mentioned, his behavior was still predictable in terms of you could predict how he's going to vote based on his strategic behavior and oral argument, even though there was less of it. And when that changed was during the pandemic, when the justices stopped hearing cases in person and started hearing them by telephone. And when they came back, they introduced a new rule that was to have, at the end of the dynamic free-for-all period, to then have a system where each justice got to speak in turn in order of seniority and to ask questions uninterrupted. And the reason that this was introduced, according to Justice Sotomayor, was because of my research showing that interruptions at the court are not fair. There's now a sort of mixed system where there is this free-for-all, but then at the end of each oral argument, there's also this exclusive period for each justice to ask questions.
Justice Thomas, it's your turn. Justice Alito? Justice Kagan? Justice Gorsuch? Justice Kavanaugh? Justice Barrett? Justice Jackson? Thank you, counsel.
And when the court returned to in-person oral argument, there was sort of this seemingly perhaps implicit, perhaps explicit agreement to let Justice Thomas speak first. And so at most oral arguments, the advocate gets 2 minutes where they are not interrupted by the justices. And then there would be a pause and Justice Thomas would ask some questions. And only when he'd finish asking two or three questions, then all the other justices would jump in, and then it'd be like a free-for-all where everybody's sort of talking over each other again.
Again, there's no rule preventing any justice from jumping in at will, but it's held now that all the justices have just let Justice Thomas go first anyway.
But yeah, there's this norm now that's developed that Justice Thomas gets to speak first, and only then does everybody sort of compete in an open dialogue. And so that got Justice Thomas speaking again. But it's sort of interesting to think about the dynamics at work there.
I'm curious, how is that new rule, the one where the Chief Justice gives each justice a chance to ask additional questions at the end, affected the dynamic of these interruptions?
Since the new rule was introduced in 2021, the advocates have improved. So the advocates aren't disproportionately interrupting the female justices anymore. So that's a good change. We still find that the male advocates and the female advocates behave differently, and that suggests that different expectations apply to, you know, male advocates versus female advocates. Female advocates just don't interrupt nearly as much. And I think that's because the reaction to that sort of misbehavior, like the advocates are explicitly told in the rules of the court not to interrupt, but it's tolerated of the male advocates. And you have to wonder whether that would be the case with the female advocates.
So the justices haven't really changed their behavior much, with the exception of Chief Justice Roberts' refereeing. But the advocates seem to be more aware of who they're interrupting and how often.
Yeah, and with Chief Justice Roberts in particular, this sort of demonstrates his awareness of the public perception of the court, the importance of impartiality in maintaining the court's reputation. Tanya's initial study provided evidence that members of the Supreme Court do not treat every person who stands in front of them, or even their own colleagues, other Supreme Court justices, with the same level of impartiality.
All right, I'm sold. I feel like this gives me a new interest in listening to oral arguments, especially because they reveal what the justices are thinking before you read their opinions months later.
Yeah. I guess you could say, in a sense, we have entered a new era, right? Where the justices are starting to reveal parts of their personalities that they'd previously left at the Supreme Court door. And Tanya gave us a warning. Be careful when you start to listen for this sort of thing. Because once you hear it, you won't be able to stop. That is it for Oral Arguments in the Supreme Court today. This episode was made by Christina Phillips with help from me, Nick Capodice, and Hannah McCarthy. Jackie Fulton is our producer, Rebecca Lavoie our executive producer. Music in this episode by Kevin MacLeod, Jules Gaia, 91 Nova, Eden Avery, The Fly Guy 5, IO, Llama House, Francis Wells, Young Community, Mini Vandals, Emily Sprague, Lobo Loco, Scott Grattan, Hanu Dixit, that's this music here, I love it, Musicom, Blue Dot Sessions, Jazar, Sarah the Instrumentalist, and the man who I wish scored every Supreme Court argument. Wouldn't that be great? Chris Zabriskie. Civics 101 is a production of NHPR, New Hampshire Public Radio.
He has the number one record for the most concurring opinions. And number two, I can hear you clicking.
All right. Should have looked it up.
I quit.
Justice Harlan.
Harlan.
The great dissenter.
Number one or two?
Number one.
Uh-huh.
The great dissenter.
John Harlan. You just asked me who holds the record.
Who holds the record?
Oh, after I read it.
Vacations are always good. Sometimes they're even great. And Celebrity Cruises is about to ruin all of that. Because once you explore with us, you'll never want a vacation any other way. And with new quick Caribbean escapes, you'll never want a weekend any other way either. Celebrity Cruises. Nothing comes close. Visit celebrity.com, call 1-800-CELEBRITY, or contact your travel advisor. Ships Registry, Malta and Ecuador.
Whether you're a morning person or a bedtime procrastinator, everyone deserves a mattress that works for their style. And you'll find the best mattress for you at Ashley. The new Tempur-Adapt collection at Ashley brings you one-of-a-kind body-conforming technology, making every sleep tailored to be your best. The collection also features cool-to-the-touch covers and motion absorption to help minimize sleep disruptions from partners, pets, or kids. Shop the all-new Tempur-Adapt collection at Ashley in-store or online at ashley.com. Ashley. For the love of home.